The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today's episode deals with a topic near and dear to our hearts, science education. How are today's teachers sharing the wonders of science and critical thinking with the next generation of students and post-students? What are they up against? How are they dealing with it? And how can you and I help? We'll be joined by cognitive psychologist and university lecturer Barbara Drescher and Mike McCrae, former science teacher and current science writer for the Education Division of Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. But before getting to the interview, I have a few news items. It is Chiropractic Awareness Week in the UK, and yesterday there was actually a reason to celebrate. The British Chiropractic Association announced that it's dropping its libel lawsuit against science journalist Simon Singh. The BCA sued after Singh wrote a column for The Guardian newspaper in which he said that the BCA happily promotes bogus treatments. 2 weeks ago, a British appeals court ruled that Singh's statement was an opinion, not a claim of fact. This would have made the BCA's case much harder to win, and so they finally decided to drop it altogether. Of course, there's still the small matter of the £200,000 Singh has spent to defend himself. He's planning to ask the court to order the BCA to pay those costs. We'll let you know how that turns out. And happy Chiropractic Awareness Week, Simon. We all appreciate you standing up for science. And on April 22nd, skeptic, critical thinking, and rational bloggers from all over the world are invited to blog about blogging. How do you start a blog? Pick a name. Get and keep readers. How do you deal with trolls, cliques, and flame wars? How has Simon Singh's case changed blogging, if at all? Why blog at all? And how is blogging different from journalism? Share your secrets and tips and learn from your peers. Because after all, what fun is it to be good and blog alone? More information and links to all the posts will be available on shethought.com. And another radio station has thrown itself behind science and critical thought. Skeptically Speaking is now being rebroadcast on CHLS 100.5 FM in Lillooet, British Columbia. Thanks very much to CHLS for taking a chance on the little skeptical radio show that could. And now, let's have some speaking up. We're here with Taylor Proctor, a geologist living in Atlanta, Georgia, with her two dogs, Bijou and Daisy. She blogs at Skeptically Distracted, where she explores the causes and implications of her own neurotic behaviors, and writes a lot about her major crush on public radio personality Ira Glass. Taylor's one of the head organizers of Skepticamp in Atlanta, and their second conference, Atlanta Skepticamp 2010, Critical Thinking for Everyone. She's also coordinating the first of its kind, Skepta Bootcamp. Welcome to Speaking Up, Taylor.
Hi, nice to speak with you again.
So before we get to Skepta Bootcamp, can you just tell us briefly what Skepticamp is?
Okay, what Skepticamp is our community organized conferences where the attendees are the participants, and whether they participate by giving a science or skeptically themed talk or by helping organize and run the event itself. I kind of like to think of it as a grown-up science fair.
That's a fantastic way to look at it. And actually, people can find a more detailed discussion of the Skepticamp model in episode 48 of Skeptically Speaking. We've done an entire episode on interactive conferences. I interviewed the creator of the Skepticamp model, Reed Issa. So you've expanded the Skepticamp model to Skepta Bootcamp. So what's that?
So what Skepta Bootcamp is designed to get you in shape for Skip Camp. And it's a series of four workshops, which take place over 4 weeks. And each workshop kind of targets a different area of preparing a presentation and public speaking and things of that nature. And really the purpose of all of it was to get more inexperienced and first-time speakers involved with and giving talks at Skeptic Camp. And I thought this would be a great way to help prepare them and maybe make the whole situation of giving a talk in front of people less intimidating.
Because that's terrifying for a lot of people, actually, just the concept of speaking in public at all.
Yes.
So, Taylor, how did you get involved with Skeptic Camp?
I attended the Skept Track at DragonCon in Atlanta in 2008, and that was really my first time really meeting any of the other local skeptics and kind of participating in an event like that. And just a few of us were sitting around at the end of the weekend and kind of thinking about maybe we should have a Skeptic Camp here, and I just kind of took on the role of organizing, and it kind of went from there. So it was really kind of a casual, laid-back kind of, I can do that.
So were you one of those people that actually happened upon skepticism by attending DragonCon and just hitting the Skept Track, or?
No, I actually, not unlike most people, found out about it through podcasts like Skepticality and Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and really I just kind of decided to go to DragonCon for that reason. I wasn't really interested in expanding my comic book collection or meeting my favorite superhero. In fact, when I arrived there, I kind of walked into the hotel and was giggling to myself because it seemed so silly. But I just went for the Skept Track. That was the only reason I went.
And you enjoyed yourself so much that you decided to organize an entire event.
Apparently.
Well done. So what kind of topics are you planning on covering? You've done one workshop in the Skeptic Bootcamp series.
We've already had our first workshop where we kind of talked about, helped each other brainstorm topics and just went over different points to help with researching a topic. The remaining three, we're going to talk about different types of presentations and different ways of giving a talk, and also different ways besides giving a talk to participate in Skeptic Camp, like maybe making a poster session or just compiling a list of information. As giving a talk might be kind of boring, but it's still useful information to have and a good way to contribute. And then the next week will be focused on how to make PowerPoint work for you with your presentation. And then the final workshop will be public speaking.
So now the Atlanta skeptics are sort of at the point where they are a very successful community, and they have a lot of people attend their skeptic camps. So you guys are more, at this point, concerned about quality over quantity then, trying to present good workshops.
Yeah, and that's really another reason for the Skeptic Boot Camp, is really to help people give better presentations. We didn't have a lot of room to expand Skeptic Camp this year as far as making it longer and having more presenters. So it was an opportunity to focus on making the presentations we do have better.
So is this going to be your first year doing a presentation?
Yes. Last year I was so involved with all the organizing and worrying about all that, I didn't even really have a chance to prepare a presentation myself. So also taking advantage of the Skeptic Boot Camp to help myself prepare to give a presentation.
So this also, so in effect, this actually gives people the chance to do a dry run of their presentation then. This is good because then they have the chance to think of answers for the questions that people are going to ask them on, you know, the big day.
Yeah, it's a chance to also practice and make sure, you know, the presentation's not too long or too short. That's kind of an issue we learned last year, was to give participants a chance to practice, because you don't really know how long your presentation will be until you really have a, you know, dry run practice, not just sitting there in your head saying things over and over in your head, to really like practice it out loud to know where you're going with it.
Have you ever had a situation where somebody came in with a presentation and realized halfway through that this just wasn't going to work at all?
No, but I can imagine that happening to me.
How much help do you usually have to give people? When they first come into Skeptic Boot Camp, do they have sort of a fully formed idea? Or is it all ranges of people that are actually attending Skeptic Boot Camp?
Well, we had at our first workshop purposely wanted them to be a small amount of people, but we helped someone come up with a presentation idea, just they had no idea, and then we helped someone take a hazy idea of a topic and kind of get it down to one question, and we helped them with ways to research a certain author and things like that. So really it's a whole range of people that were there, and also a whole range of people who were there to help them out and give them helpful information.
That's brilliant. How many people actually attended the Atlanta Skeptic Camp last year?
About 40 or 50 people attend, and we had 14 presenters.
That's fantastic. And how many do you expect this year?
I'm not sure. I hope more. Right now we have about 6 spaces left for speakers, and still about a month away, so I'm not really sure how many people are planning to attend and help with organizing and running the event and such, but I hope there's a larger turnout.
So are there other benefits to holding a Skepta Boot Camp before a Skepta Camp, do you think, beside the actual training the trainer part of it?
In my opinion, Skepta Camps are the best way to strengthen and grow your local skeptical community, because you are learning from each other. And Skepta Boot Camp kind of extends that ways to learn from each other and kind of furthers the community building component of Skepta Camp. And also, it's not just Skepta Boot Camp itself. A lot of cities are having their second and third Skepta Camps, and you kind of need to have ways and have new ideas that keep Skepta Camps effective in their purpose and keep people interested in attending and participating.
So the Atlanta Skepta Camp is coming up on May 15th and 16th?
That is correct.
And where can people find out more?
Everything and all things Atlanta Skeptic Camp you can find at atlantaskeptics.com/skepticcamp.
Fantastic idea. Thanks very much for being here, Taylor.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, CJLY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI, Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, WPRR Public Reality Radio, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, CIDO, 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia, UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, CFAD 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia, and CHLS 100.5 FM in Lillooet, British Columbia.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We have two guests today. Mike McRae is an Australian science writer and illustrator for the Education Division of Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. In the past, he's worked as a secondary school science teacher in Australia and in the UK. And more recently, he's contributed to the development of school environmental curriculum programs with a focus on improving students' critical literacy skills. We're also pleased to have Barbara Drescher on the line, scientist and lecturer at California State University Northridge. She's researching perception, reasoning, and attention. She's a co-founder of the Critical Thinking Education Group and develops materials for the teaching of quantitative research methods and critical thinking. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Mike and Barb. So, science education. How are we doing on that? Too broad?
It depends on what you mean by, you've got someone here from Australia and someone from the US and was speaking on a Canadian show. So, really, it's quite variable all over the place. And I think different countries have different strengths and different weaknesses when it comes to science education.
Well, we hear a lot about today's students being less scientifically literate than in the past. What does that mean?
You know, I'm not sure that that's a proper assumption either. Certainly, there's been a lot of reports in the media and so forth about how illiterate Americans are scientifically, but, you know, compared to what? And compared to the past, compared to other countries, and what do we mean by scientifically literate, too? I mean, to me, scientifically literate is more than just knowing facts that science has produced. It's understanding the process, because science is really a process of acquiring knowledge. And scientific literacy, to me, means that you understand where knowledge comes from.
Mike, would you agree?
Yeah, it really depends on what you mean by science. I think this is one of the big problems we tend to face when it comes to science literacy. We understand the literacy part. We understand what it means to be literate in a particular field. But understanding the science part can be quite tricky, in that science can be understood from several different angles. You can be looking at science in terms of the product of it. You know, people can be very technologically literate. They might know a lot about science facts, science trivia. But then you've also got the process of science. And that's a little bit harder to actually communicate and a bit harder to evaluate how well people are doing. So there's a lot of miscommunication, I think, between people, that you can have one group say, yep, we are very scientifically literate, and a lot of people who know a lot about technology, they can tell you a lot of facts about physics and biology. However, they're not very clear on how science works as a process. And two people can use the word science and be meaning two subtly different things, and I think that's something we do have to nail.
So do you think that this perception comes from standardized testing then?
Personally, I think the perception comes from the fact that in the past it's been a lot easier to teach science as a product. And I also think it comes from an understanding of something called the deficit model of education, which is, if I can teach you stuff, if I can give you bits of information and, you know, treat you, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who called it the banking model of education, and the name's kind of in my head at the moment, but basically meaning I give you the information and you just absorb it and put it in your skull. And so we treat science very much as a lot of stuff, not really the skills or the processes behind it. And it's very easy to do that. I can teach you things to little bits of trivia, and it's very easy to evaluate because I just check to make sure you know that, and I can dust my hands and say, well, now you know science. So I have a funny feeling it's really has a lot to do with education in the past being very content-driven. So we understand science as being all of these facts, but we've been very light on the process behind it.
We hear a lot about how schools are just teaching memorization. They're not teaching students how to think. Would you say that there's actually truth to that?
I think there's some truth to that, certainly. And there are exceptions. I mean, my children's schools have been very, very good at teaching them process and they get it, you know, they learn. But I have a feeling that my kids' teachers are exceptional. And what I see in the college classroom tells me that not everybody's doing that job very well. And I really think that this is a product of how are we assessing them. If you're going to assess knowledge in using multiple choice tests and you're going, you know, standardized testing, and you're going to have a set of facts that they need to know, then that's what they're going to be taught, and that's what they're going to remember. And they're only going to remember it long enough to take the test. They won't necessarily carry that over. They won't necessarily understand how those facts, or even if they're taught some process, they don't necessarily understand how that relates to other processes or other sets of knowledge. For instance, they might think that a process to find something out in chemistry is very different than to find it out in biology or in psychology, and they are very different, but in general, they're the same.
Audience, we are taking emails at live@skepticallyspeaking.com and tweets at Skeptical Radio. So it seems like one of the big issues is that everyone seems to have an opinion on this. We have the teachers and the school administrators and the parents and governments and then the students, and they all seem to have different perspectives on how to provide science education and how to evaluate the success of that. So we have the standardized testing aspect, first of all. Now, who's in favor of standardized testing?
Oh, not me.
Okay.
I think it can have its place. I think with a lot of things in education, they start off as really great ideas, and they get they get tested in a particular capacity, but they get tested in a best-case scenario. So you put it in a school, or you put it into a situation where they have full resources, everyone's watching. It's not always a good school, but they're trying hard to actually meet the goals of the test. And so then you take this system where, you know, no matter what it is, you implement it in a real-world scenario, and it falls apart because it doesn't have all the pieces there. And I suspect that's kind of the case with standardized testing. You know, there's some good ideas with implementing it, but then when you apply it in the real world, it sort of falls apart and it doesn't do what it's supposed to.
Barb, you're anti-standardized testing?
I would agree with that. I think that the problem is not that standardized testing is bad. It's that it has to constantly evolve and change, or we fall into using it, you know, incorrectly, teaching to the test.
Right. So now standardized testing leads to a rating system of the schools themselves?
In the United States, it does,
In the United States, but not in Australia.
Well, we don't quite have that. We do have some standardized tests, and there's an interesting situation at the moment where we're leaning in that direction. We've actually got the federal government is putting together a website that parents can check, and this is causing a huge rift at the moment, actually. You've got certain tests that are going out, the teachers are just saying, we're not going to be implementing them, we're not going to be using them. So there's a big rift between the teaching union and the federal government right now, simply because the federal government says, we're going to be putting up this website. This website ranks schools, so a parent can go online and see which schools are good and which schools are bad, and that just does not work. Now, the fascinating thing I find that is actually a bit of a social comment behind it is the excuse that the government seems to be using is parents are loving this. They're using the parental approval as a way of giving the big tick to their system. Whereas on the other side, you've got the teachers saying, hey, we're teachers. This is what we do for a profession. We do this. We live this every day. And you're just not listening. And I find it interesting that the government is not addressing that concern. They're not saying, well, look, here we're going to be critically evaluating what you're telling us. We're going to be skeptical of the teachers. They're just simply saying, well, no, the parents say it's good, therefore it must be. And it's an interesting situation, actually, showing it's teachers still don't quite have that level of respect to say, you understand your profession well enough. It's more what the parents want, who may not actually be teachers or have all that good an idea of education in the first place.
So why exactly are the parents so supportive of this? Is it because it's easy?
It's information. You know, it's to me, I mean, when you were talking about it, it sounds a lot like ratemyprofessors.com. That's, you know, just a site where people can go and say whatever they want about teachers, and it sticks. And then students go there thinking that, well, I'll hear what everybody else has to say. Unfortunately, it's not simply a matter of it's an unbiased sample. It's also a matter of students really, consumers even, don't really understand always what it is that makes a teacher good or bad or helps them learn or, you know, leads to longer learning. If you're in a classroom and you feel good because the teacher's making you feel good, does that mean they're a good teacher? Sometimes the toughest teachers or the hardest teachers 5 years down the road are the ones that you remember and appreciate what you learned in their class. But when you're in the classroom isn't necessarily the time that you're understanding that. So it's kind of a free-for-all.
Is school funding dependent on these ratings?
Not at the moment, not in Australia.
Not in Australia.
It's simply a system for parents to be able to look at these schools and see how they're doing. But you know, obviously there have been similar systems in other countries. You've got your Ofsted report in the UK that parents can look at and that schools actually do use to evaluate the system to say whether or not what sort of funding they may or may not get. And, of course, we have seen similar sort of stuff happen in the US where you do get funding that relies on how well a school is doing according to a set of results. So we're not quite there in Australia, but it wouldn't surprise me if somewhere further down the track we do get something that basically relies on a set of results to say whether or not you get certain funding. And I think that's kind of scary.
You know, I was thinking about that this the other day, actually. The problems that we have with education today, you know, the solution is always to come up with more and better ways to track things. And unfortunately, that's not always the best way to do it. For example, there were articles about, well, fire the bad teachers. How are you deciding who the bad teachers are? Is it the scores of the students in their classroom? Because that's not necessarily a good measure.
Right.
how classrooms are put together is usually done by the teachers themselves, because especially at the elementary level, because they understand the children, they understand the children's personalities and their needs. And so they help to decide whose classroom should this child be in next year. Well, these are also people that they work with. They're friends of theirs. If their income or the school's, you know, ratings or so forth is reliant on those test scores, what is to keep them from just putting the smartest kids in that class?
Yeah, teaching is a very closed-door profession, and I think that often goes against it because it's very difficult to get a good idea of what's happening behind those doors. You can go into a school and you can get the school administration to put a program in place, for instance, and you can workshop it and you can put professional development in. But when those teachers go away and put it in their classroom, you really don't know exactly what they're doing because you can't go in there, sit them there, watch them. You can't really videotape all these teachers and then evaluate them later. So it's quite tricky to get a good idea of really how a teacher operates and what they're doing. And this is a problem then when you look at how the system works, and you know there are good and bad teachers out there. We've all got experience of that. However, really finding a way of getting better teachers and rewarding those teachers who are putting the hard yards in and finding the teachers who are struggling isn't as clear-cut as we'd like it to be.
Well, how are we currently teaching science? I understand there's a multitude of ways.
Yeah, very differently, and I think that's a huge thing. There are some teachers who are absolutely brilliant. They have a very intuitive way of getting science across. They get kids interested in it, and they do a brilliant job. Then there are those teachers who are still doing the 1950s textbook method of, you know, turn to page 54, read the text, and answer the questions. And you've got the full spectrum in between. And I think that is really where the problem lies, is it's not so much that we have bad teachers, it's just we've got such a range of good and bad teachers, and there's nothing to standardize and say, here's where we should be, here's how we're going to evaluate it, and if you are not meeting this level of requirement, then we're going to have to actually get you some form of professional development so you do meet those levels.
There's also, I think, going back to your statement that everybody has an opinion, I think that most teachers and parents and principals, they all have different ideas about what makes a good curriculum. You know, what should the pedagogy be? What should the approach be? Everybody has a different idea about that. And I think that contributes to that wide range of approaches.
How are we actually judging what's working and what's not at this point then?
Standardized test scores.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that seems to be the way, at least trying to look at all the different areas and saying, well, how do we rate them? How do we look them together? It depends on really how you're answering that, I guess. Are you looking at science in terms of a practical application? In other words, kids coming out of school, going into a science-related university degree and maybe getting a job in a science-related area. That's one way of evaluating it. Or, you know, standardized testing, or do you look at how each school might actually be evaluating the school itself or what they're doing in terms of science? And they're all going to give you slightly different answers.
We have a question submitted via the website on this topic.
Hi, just wanted to firstly say a big thank you to Barbara for writing what she did about scientific skepticism on her site. It was a real eye-opener that showed me how some skeptic websites don't seem to realize that skepticism isn't make it what you want to be, much like feminism isn't what you want it to be. My question is for Michael, though. Your profile on your Tokum Skeptic interview said that you work for a government body that is for science and industry. What factors encourage science literacy, if such a term is right? And is it true that science shows skeptic demonstrations aren't as educationally effective as they may seem to be? And that's from Jay Ling.
Yeah, interesting question in that the answer to both of them is we don't know. And this is a huge problem in that, as you said before, you know, we all have our different opinions, but as skeptics well know, you know, an opinion's one thing, but you need to be able to back it up with observations that support what you're saying. And we don't have a lot of good data on either of those. Science literacy, as I was saying before, you know, we understand what literacy means, but it really depends on what you mean by science. So we might have a lot of people who may know lots of science bits of trivia and facts, but they may not be very good at understanding the process. And we have the reverse. Some people who don't know a lot of little bits and pieces of science, but they're very good critical thinkers. They're very, they've got that scientific mind and they're very eager to find bits of information to support what they're saying. The second part of the question is something that we are addressing. I've actually got a friend of mine who is studying at the Center of Public Awareness of Science at the Australian National University, who happens to be looking at how science demonstrations and how science shows work. And even though it's early days, it's not looking all that good for science shows because there is a lot of variety in how successful they are. For the most part, it seems standing up in front of a group and simply doing a demonstration does very, very little. All they might do is associate what you're doing, if it's exciting, with the fact that science might be interesting. But information isn't gotten across. There really isn't much of the process. So it could be that a lot of demonstrations, a lot of science shows, simply don't do what the people are setting out to do. And that is, hopefully, their aim is to actually communicate some science, if not a love of science.
Barb, did you want to follow up on that?
I would really be interested in finding out what they see there. I think that probably what we're going to see is that some approaches work and some don't. Just as Mike said, we can stand there and, you know, show them, hey, this works this way or that works that way. But if they're not questioning it and they're not really making the connection between we didn't know and now we do, then I think there's an issue there.
Yeah, connection is a big part of it. People might not express a great love of science. They may actually state categorically before you talk to them or before you do a show, look, we don't like science. But if the actual show itself doesn't portray itself as being specifically about that topic, and if it is something that may be related to them, it could be full of science stuff, but they never really realize that they're actually seeing the science behind it. And people will tend to actually like it. So it needs to be relevant. And it's these little things, I think, that are quite important to understand when it comes to communicating science and skepticism effectively. I guess having two things. One, really knowing what your goal is. It still surprises me how many people, you know, science communicators or skeptics communicators, will go into this and say, I want to do the show, I want to write a blog, or I want to do this. And you go, that's fantastic. What is your goal? What are you hoping to get? There's a blank look. They know that there's something there they want to be doing. They know they want to make a difference. They know that they want society to be a little bit different in to how it is now, and that they want to be more scientifically educated or more scientifically literate. But what that looks like seems to be a bit lost. And I think that's a really big thing, is knowing precisely what is your aim, what is that going to look like if you're successful, and then step back afterwards and look for that and go, actually, you know, I'm seeing these things that count as a success. And I think in the past that's been done poorly with a lot of science shows, in that people will stand up and do a show. They'll get a lot of smiles, they'll get cheering, and they go, oh, I've been successful. Where really we're now finding they haven't been successful in the way that they might actually really want to hope, and that is those people go away and behave differently when it comes to science.
Right. We're talking about long-term, measurable outputs. And that's difficult with this topic.
Definitely. It is. And sometimes the effect of what you've seen doesn't hit you right away. You might say, oh, that was cool. You know, that was neat. My kids do it all the time. They come home and say, oh, I saw this today. But what really gets me is when we're watching some TV show and they'll say, oh, this is just like that. And it's something completely different. And they've made a connection. And it was well after the fact.
So what's a better way of communicating science then? Mike, you work on science by email. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, it's a weekly e-newsletter that goes out. It's free, and it basically contains a news story and, importantly, an activity that uses really simple materials around the home to communicate some sort of a scientific concept. To answer your question, though, how to do it effectively, I think really it needs to be seen as a cumulative approach. There is not going to be any one single thing that will do it. There's no such thing as a single one hit that you can go to school, you learn science, you come away, you're now scientifically literate. This is a community thing. It's a social thing. We need to have many different approaches. So I don't pretend that my publication is actually going to make a huge difference, especially on its own. There are many different approaches that can be taken that will each do their little bit. So someone who goes from one social group, so it might be school, they go home, home appreciates science on a particular level, they might have science textbooks and things like that there, and there's a general atmosphere of liking science. Their friends might like it on a particular level, and all of that accumulates to make someone scientifically literate. If you have someone who just in one area, they go to school, yeah, they kind of like science there, but they go home and it's really frowned upon, they don't like it there, you know, their friends aren't big into it, you're probably not going to get a scientifically literate person coming out in the end.
We have a question from the chat room.
If standardized tests include open-ended written questions, does that encourage critical thinking and science process?
I think it can. It certainly can. The issue that you then have, though, with open-ended questions, and actually the GRE has changed. They used to have a logic component, you know, an analytical component, and now it's analytical writing. The problem that you have then is twofold, cost effectiveness and subjectivity. You have to make sure that whomever is grading these, there is some standard and that they recognize it, because, you know, these aren't cut and dry. They're not there isn't one single wording or one single answer that communicates exactly what the answer is with anything open-ended. And the other issue is when you're grading something like that and it is subjective, that means a person has to grade it. And as somebody who never does multiple choice tests, I can tell you that is extremely time consuming. And so standardized tests and public education in particular, I mean, the cost, we're talking about a huge difference from what we do now, which is just stick things into computers.
Audience, you can email live@skepticallyspeaking.com and tweet Skeptical Radio. So you're talking about the teacher's role in this. So what kind of support are they getting to learn new methods? Actually, professional development, I guess, is what we're talking about. What kind of support is there there?
Again, I think it depends on the country and depends on the borough or the district or the board. But personally, from what I've seen, I haven't seen too many areas where really that has done well. It seems most professional industries get a fair bit of time to go out and learn new things. I even know my position now, it's one of those things I know I can, throughout the year, go and do a whole lot of different professional development, and it's really encouraged. Teaching suffers from the problem that you need to be in the classroom a certain percentage of days in the year, and parents really don't like it if their teachers are constantly taking time off to go and learn things, because it means, what are you going to do with your kids? It kind of treats the education system as a giant babysitting system, mm-hmm. but the reality is that's how a lot of parents see it. Is they go to work, they rely on the fact their kids are going to be at school, and what do you do with them? So there really isn't a lot of time for professional development for teachers. They might get a few days out of the year, but what seems to be the case with that, what they've found, is professional development, if it's crammed into just a couple of days of going outside of the school setting, sitting in some place, learning how it works, it doesn't translate back to the school. It's quickly forgotten. Teachers don't feel very confident in being able to implement it. And so even the professional development a lot of teachers get, as small as it is completely useless. It just really doesn't translate into any big changes. The school itself needs to be adopting it as a cultural change, and that in itself is really quite a tricky thing. So professional development is pretty much one of the biggest answers to improving education, in my view, but it's the field that's done the most poorly.
Barb?
I'm just kind of speaking from my experience. I'm sure that this varies a great deal across the country, but professional development's very strongly emphasized here, at least, you know, with my kids' schools and so forth. And there are actually, contractually and legally, they have to have a certain amount of time for professional development and so forth. And it does take them away from the classroom quite a bit. I'm sure that there are parents who are not happy when their kids come home a couple of days a week and say, well, we had another substitute today. But I think my concern is I'm not sure what the quality is like. I mean, I've spoken to teachers that have had great experiences, learned quite a bit in the classes that were provided to them, but I don't know how uniform that is. So yeah, I'm skeptical about it. And I also think that there are so many resources available to teachers. The question is, if you implement those resources, what is the outcome now? Let me just give you an example of what I'm saying. If you go to the website for the No Child Left Behind Act, which is actually, it's really just a reboot of an act that was passed in the 60s, there's a link to, you know, a website with great resources on how we should be teaching, and they are evidence-based techniques, things that we know work, and they're very accurate. The problem is, what they're telling teachers to do in the classroom, it doesn't match with the assessment that they're giving. The assessments are standardized tests that are mostly multiple choice.
Right.
And so they're telling teachers to space out material and require students to, you know, ask them deep questions, things that probe understanding, things that make them think and make connections and so forth. But that isn't necessarily what's going to get them high scores on these multiple choice tests of facts and so forth. And so you kind of have this gap between what we're telling them works and then how we're actually assessing whether they're doing a good job or not. And so I always go back to, I think really the problem, if we even have one, the problem really is how we're assessing this. And I'm not sure I have an answer for that.
We have an email question.
Teachers often find that they need resources and support that are not readily available to them from their school system. Many practicing scientists understand this and would like the opportunity to be involved in the public school system. One Alberta group that attempts to expedite this is the Alberta Science Literacy Association. Would teachers gain by having the opportunity to have partnerships with scientists that are interested and have the skills to be part of their classroom? Do we need more practicing scientists in the classroom? And that's from Gary in Medicine Hat.
Definitely. We've actually got something in Australia that is very similar. I'm aware of the Alberta Science Literacy Association, what they're doing with teachers, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. We've got a program here that we help run called the Scientists in Schools program, and that's been going for a couple of years now. We've got well over 1,000 partnerships between scientists and teachers all over Australia. And it had an evaluation that was done after its pilot program and found that it was a resounding success in many areas that they felt was lacking beforehand. And one of the big areas that is lacking, especially amongst primary school teachers, is a confidence in teaching science. Science is often thought of by especially a lot of primary school teachers as being something that's a little bit either complicated or a little bit esoteric. It's full of jargon and complicated concepts. And they don't feel that they can do it justice in getting it across quite often. Having a scientist in the classroom, probably the biggest thing it did was present science as something that's accessible. Here's a real person who has real interests that have nothing to do with science quite often, coming into the classroom and sharing their love of science and their experience and their understanding of it, and showing actually science is not that complicated. You know, here's an actual person who doesn't have antennae coming out of their head, communicating something that is accessible. So after a few years of this running, it's still doing quite well, and there's still quite a few partnerships across the country that are absolutely loving having a scientist come into the classroom quite regularly. It could be once a week, it could be once a month. That's between the scientist and the teacher. But for the school to have a practicing scientist come in and the kids can actually see this person who is an actual person who has these traits is absolutely invaluable. The one problem, however, is the fact that it is quite resource heavy. This is something where you do need a team behind the program who can match up the scientists with teachers, who can run professional development for the scientists so they know what to expect when they go into the classroom, and who can also set up the classroom so then they can get the most out of the scientist. So to answer the question, yes, it's an absolutely brilliant program. It really does work well. However, like most things, it really does need to have a good structure behind it.
Barb, did you want to add to that?
You know, actually, I'm thinking that a program like that is awesome. I mean, we have scientists in entertainment, you know, connection now. Mm-hmm. So why couldn't we have something in education? But I'm thinking of something actually very less structured, and that is, what about teachers asking students, parents, cousins, that sort of thing, to come in and give presentations, just like, you know, back in the 50s and when I was in school. Parents came in and talked about their job. My youngest is doing health right now. They just entered their health unit, and they've had a nurse, an emergency room surgeon, and an EMT, I believe, come in, and they were all relatives of classmates or former classmates. And so they've kind of built this resource themselves just with talking to students and parents. And I'm sure that would be a problem in smaller schools or more rural areas where you have fewer occupations to choose from. But there are enough scientists in the world, you know? And if we're not excited about our jobs, then why are we doing them? You know, excited enough to share.
I think one thing we need to be careful with that is there's a big difference between having a parent come in, say, on a particular day, and you share what your parent does, which is fantastic. And believe me, if the scientist can be related to somebody who is in the school, all the better, because it does create that community connection a lot more, which is a great thing. However, the good thing about having programs like this, though, is quite often scientists or people in different scientific fields, they do have a job that they have to do. And when they're at work and they're kind of saying to their boss, look, I need to go into my kid's school once a month or once a week, there needs to be some additional incentive. There needs to be something behind it to actually say to the organization, this is a good thing. We can count this off as professional development for your employee. We can give you some sort of a certification to say you're doing this to help your community. And there are more and more examples in organizations where they are required to actually demonstrate they are doing some sort of community work. So having all of that set up and working can make it a lot easier and actually get people. Because, I mean, parents do want to go into their kids' classes. You do have your uncles who want to go into their nieces and nephews' classroom and help out and share this. So I don't think it's a lack of drive or interest. It's just having that infrastructure there to make it as easy as possible for people to do that.
And we'll be right back with more on science education right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we sit down with Vancouver rapper and Litfuse Records founder Baba Brinkman. He's the humanist hip-hop artist behind the Rap Guide to Evolution, the new humanist anthem Off That, and award-winning Rap Canterbury Tales. And on Speaking Up, skeptical madman Jason Brown plugs us into the Skepticator, a new website collecting skeptical content from all over the web. Science Beats and Skeptic Feeds, next week on Skeptically Speaking. Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We are here with Barb Drescher, cognitive psychologist and university lecturer, and Mike McRae, former science teacher and current science writer for the Education Division of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. So let's go to another question from the website.
I'd like to get some practical advice as to how to promote critical thinking in the science classroom. I already do some things, but I'd love to learn some more. That's from Lotem, an Israeli science teacher.
Who wants it?
You should jump in.
All right, yeah. Probably the biggest advice I can give is to never underestimate the strength of role modeling as a teacher. Now, I think a lot of teachers know this, and I don't think it's surprising, but I think it bears sometimes emphasizing that what you do is often a lot more powerful than what you say. Critical thinking is a really difficult thing to teach, especially as a content-driven exercise. However, if you can actually show the process of critical thinking, I think that's a big thing. The second thing I'd probably recommend is really encouraging in your students an attitude of daring to be wrong. Critical thinking at its core is about looking at what you know and how you're willing to change your mind on things in the face of new evidence. And if you've got an attitude that says, I must always be correct, then you will tend to preserve that. And I think in education we're quite often taught to be bad critical thinkers purely for the fact that if you think about the way a lot of classes will actually be run, you'll have information, teacher gives it to you, you put up your hand. If you correctly give that information, you get praise. If you incorrectly give that information, you'll get some sort of negative reinforcement, whether it's simply being told you're wrong or, you know, in some extreme cases, you may be punished for it or simply ignored. You know, it's simply the teacher will move on to the correct answer and they will get more recognition. So it reinforces in you an idea that whatever you say, it really must be correct. And we don't get the opportunity then to test out our ideas, feeling safe. You know what, if it's wrong, that's still a good thing because now I'm learning how to correct it. So I think setting up a culture in your classroom of comparing between students ideas that could well be wrong, but that's still a good thing. You're sharing your ideas and we can critically evaluate them in an atmosphere of positive reinforcement. And that includes you in there. So, you know, you can say something, come back later and say, you know, I thought this. I'm going to show you how I changed my mind on this in the light of this new information. And sometimes that new information can come from the students. So there's nothing better than standing in front of a group of kids, having them point something out to you. And then you go, wow, actually, if that's correct, I could be wrong. That really shows them that they've got that ability then to take something they know, and it's a good thing to say, I was wrong before. In light of this new information, I'm going to change my mind.
I really love that idea that we have to be comfortable with being wrong. And I think that we also have to make them comfortable with being wrong, not just by modeling, but by showing them that everybody is wrong. One thing that I incorporate, I actually kind of incorporate two things in the classroom is kind of no matter what it is I'm talking about, I always do these two things. And this is also for presentations, you know, at conferences or so forth with adults. One is I always shake them up and show them that humans are humans and that we're always wrong. And I think that gives us a perspective. Not we're always wrong. I'm sorry. That we can be wrong.
So really, always?
All of us do certain things. Yeah. All of us do certain things wrong. And there are actually things that we don't even have control of, even when we are aware of it. Things like visual illusions, that there's really nothing that we can do, even cognitively, to change that. And I think that gives us a perspective. Back in my early 20s, somebody gave me some great advice once, and it had nothing to do with science, but it's carried me through that. And that is, sometimes you want to do something you're really bad at just to get that perspective of failing. Because when you realize that you have said something wrong or you've had some wrong thought, and then you suddenly realize that it was wrong, you also realize that being wrong isn't the end of the world, that the world isn't going to fall apart because you gave a wrong answer or because you found something and it turned out to be wrong. And that kind of opens your mind to being able to let go of what you know so that you can evaluate evidence critically and objectively rather than using what you already think to be true. The other thing is I rather than telling them what the answer is when they ask a question, I make them answer it. I make them think about it. I make them walk through it. Make them get to the answer themselves because they're much, much, much more likely to remember it and to understand, you know, what it's all about if they produced it.
Well, the other good thing just on that topic there, Barb, is treating answers, I guess, as sometimes less of a dichotomy. And that's an excellent way of doing it, is if they arrive at it, and instead of gauging it as right or wrong, because it almost gives information this absolute nature. Yes, information may be absolute, but our knowledge of it never is, and that's kind of the core of skepticism. So I think if you can treat information as something that is a confidence level and always get students to gauge how confident they are in an answer. The more confident they are, and it relates to the amount of evidence they have, then you can give them a sense of, well, the more likely are to be correct. Sometimes you can't avoid it. If you're going to be evaluating them, it is a dichotomy. It is right or it is wrong. So I'm not saying this is something you can always do, but I think encouraging in your class a bit of a culture of evaluating things on a likelihood of being right rather than absolute can help help your teaching a critical thinking a bit.
So how can we extend this to adults? We have 2 minutes left.
I'm actually talking about adults. I teach adults. So for me, I'm always thinking about shaking them up, really, because, of course, they have more beliefs to let go of. So for me, that's just a really important thing, is that we show them that you have to be willing to kind of open up and be okay with being wrong. And that doesn't mean that you're always saying, well, I have to be open-minded. There's a point at which there's enough evidence that you draw a conclusion, but you hold on to that conclusion tentatively, always.
I'm actually skeptical of really whether it is possible, to be honest. And I'd love there to be, and I'd love us to keep looking for it, but there's a lot of evidence to say that your epistemology, your way of actually evaluating, determining knowledge, is pretty set in place by adolescence. And if you think about adolescence being such an upheaval of social groups, so you go from your family being your core social group to you then go through school and then you get your friends coming into it. Pretty much after that, your way of evaluating things in terms of your social setting doesn't change a great deal. And so I'd love there to be, if you have a certain epistemology by the time you hit university, I'd love there to be a way that will permanently change that. I'd need to see some evidence to say that is possible. So sometimes I do wonder whether the best we can hope for in skeptical communication when it comes to adults is preaching to the converted, is actually making people who are skeptical feel as if they belong to a part of a global community. But the converse of that is pretty much saying that when it comes to teaching skepticism or teaching people to be critical, we really do need to be focusing on the younger generation.
And that's our time for today. Thanks so much to both of you, Barb and Mike, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And you can find Barb at her blog, icbseverywhere.com, and you can find Mike at csiro.au. And before we say goodbye, I just want to mention one more thing. I received an email this week from Kylie Sturgis, another brilliant Australian skeptical teacher, a reporter for the Skeptic Zone podcast, and the host of her own podcast, The Token Skeptic. She was sent a wonderful bit of fan mail. Josh Bonnet, a gentleman who had listened to her episode on Skeptically Speaking, the one where she appeared with Martin Bridgestock to discuss belief in education, was inspired to write a song called Science Girl. It should go without saying that we love everything about this. So Josh is a musician from Brisbane, Australia, who has composed a completely unrelated musical called Dr. Glee, which tells the story of the half-good, half-evil mad scientist named Dr. Glee and her invention, the the melodilipulator, a machine that controls people's minds, infecting them with song and dance. The show runs June 17th to the 26th at the Centre Stage Theatre in Spring Hill, Brisbane, Australia. And you can find Josh at myspace.com/Josh Bonnet Music. And Bonnet is spelled B-O-N-N-E-T-T. And you can visit our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links that take you to our Facebook page, to us on Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. So we're going to close today with Science Girl. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. I had a girl. Dog with psychic powers, and I couldn't take another hour. I gave her opportunities to change her mind, but she just said no. No way. I knew a girl. It just lies on palms. No fortune telling necessary. Hey, yeah, hey, yeah. I want a science girl. She'll know what to do when I got the flu. She won't lay blame to my shoes on the table. I want a science girl. She'll know with her beautiful mind. Scientifically stable, superstitiously disabled. Yeah, I knew a girl. Scientifically stable.
religiously unable. I kissed a girl in the glimmer of crystals. She sold dream catchers, blessed by guardian angels. I said, you're a fool to still believe childish things like that. She said I was evil and my aura was black.